Hello, I'm Dr. Felix Beecher, and this is the Medical AI Podcast, a 30-minute thrill ride of big ideas. We talk to a range of top guests, from industry innovators to scientists to philosophers. This is brought to you by Informatech, where I'm the head of healthcare technology. It has been said that the first rule of innovation is that it takes time. However, with medical AI, delays in deployment have life and death consequences. So how is real-world deployment going? What are the golden rules for getting it right? With me to discuss this is Louis Coulot, head of innovation capabilities for one of the biggest healthcare companies in the world, Philips Healthcare. Louis, I'm very, very pleased to have you on. A warm welcome.
Yeah, nice to be here, Felix.
So, Louis, could you just introduce yourself and explain a little bit about what you do at Philips Healthcare?
Yes, certainly. So I've been at Philips for about 7 years. Now, the first half of my career was really in an area called chemical computing. So we were developing tools and platforms for life science companies, primarily engaged in drug research. And then I moved into genetics and clinical genetics, and that's what landed me specifically into healthcare just prior to coming to Philips. So that's about me. At Philips, our businesses, and when we say businesses here, we mean businesses like, we call them image-guided therapy or ultrasound. Most people know what an ultrasound is. Well, we have a business built around ultrasound, enterprise informatics, so informatics, software for healthcare systems. These are our businesses. And these are really leading the innovation continuously with our customers and some of what I think are the most impactful challenges in healthcare. Now, in my role, my team develops capabilities. So these are tools, processes, expertise, often in the form of people, and data, which enable Philips to lead in healthcare innovation. So enabling innovation around data and AI is one of the cornerstone capabilities that we develop.
Okay, so could you summarize what areas of medical AI Philips is involved in developing?
Yeah, I can give you a few quick examples. We publicize some of these things. You can find them on the Philips website. But for example, for CT imaging, sometimes called CAT scan or computed tomography. When you have a CT image, you're exposed to radiation. Everybody is for any CT exam. So one of the areas we've applied AI is using what are called convolutional neural networks to reconstruct images from lower dose CT. And this is important because anything we can do to lower the exposure of radiation for an exam is a win for patients, but we have to do this in a way that doesn't compromise any of the diagnostic utility of the exam. So that's an example. In ultrasound, to shift gears a little bit, we have AI tools that semi-automate the measurements of certain cardiac features. So the clinician's always in control. They're always making the determination of the exam, but these are speeding the process along for them and providing some aids, such as measuring the right ventricle volume or the ejection fraction. These are cardiac features that they need for a diagnosis. And I can list some others, but those are the sort of areas that we're working in. So we're thinking about how do we help our healthcare providers be more efficient with their time. We know from all the healthcare providers we talk to, they're incredibly stressed in terms of the amount of time that they have to actually spend with their patients. And so we're trying to use AI in ways that can relieve that burden. Sometimes that comes with helping on the clinical side. Often it's on the operational side. So as an example, one of the things that we've developed is something called Patient Flow Capacity Suite. And this uses an AI model to predict the likelihood of a 30-day readmission event. So you can imagine someone's about to be discharged from a hospital. One of the big costs to a healthcare system would be to have that patient come back within 30 days for readmission. And that's costly to the system. It's costly to the, obviously very disturbing to the patient. And so we have used AI to help on the operational side as well.
I see. Okay, so now there's a big difference, obviously, between what we can do with medical AI, the technology, and what actually happens in clinical practice. So could you, based on your experience with Philips Healthcare, just talk about how you think the process of deployment is going in general terms?
Yeah, so, and maybe this was you can sort of tell by my answers in the areas that we're working in. Where things I think are going very well are where we can land AI-enabled propositions directly inside the workflows, the clinical workflows, and importantly, demonstrate the value to our customers. So we have something we call, in across healthcare, we call the quadruple aim in healthcare. So quadruple aim is we're trying to achieve four things at once. And those four things are, hey, can we improve patient outcomes? Can we reduce costs? Can we improve the patient satisfaction? And can we improve the satisfaction of the staff? And it turns out that if you only achieve three of those four things, it's actually very hard to land a proposition. So one of the things that we always go back to with any of the solutions we build, whether they're AI enabled or not, is already achieving that quadruple aim. So if you go back to the examples I gave earlier, another one we have, for example, in MRI imaging is something we call smart speed, and it just flat out reduces exam time. So it frees up capacity in the instrument, so you can actually have more patients come through a given MRI piece of equipment. The patients like it because it's faster for them, right? Who doesn't want to get out of that MRI exam faster? Staff likes it because it's completely seamless for them. They don't have to do anything special; it just kind of works. And it reduces the overall cost because you freed up that capacity. So it's an example, I think, of where things actually go really well.
Sure. Okay. So could you give an example of, let's say, a scan of the brain, which for a usual MRI machine might take, I don't know, what, 8, 9, maybe at most 10 minutes? How much would this kind of tool reduce that scan time by?
I'd have to go look up the exact number, but I think it's on the order of around 20% reduction, okay, something like that. So significant enough that it you know, people will actually feel it and measure it.
Now, if you took all MRI machines in the whole of the United States, which is where you're based, what proportion roughly of those machines would you say have some kind of AI systems for reducing scans implemented in them? Is the figure like more like 5% or 95%? Are we at the sort of beginning, or is this kind of market for AI tools fairly mature in some ways?
Yeah, I really like the question, but I think it depends on how you slice it, right? So if I were to say, well, you know, how many products does, if you have a Philips medical product, you know, how many of them are AI enabled or have some AI component somewhere in there? It's probably a pretty high number. But if you were to say, what is the opportunity space for applying AI, say, across an imaging workflow, from the time a patient, say, schedules an exam to the time the radiologist gives them the report, and look at it sort of horizontally, we're only probably single-digit percent impacting that end-to-end flow. And I think you can do that across these different areas. So not so much like how many of the devices that we have some AI somewhere, but if you think about it from a horizontal, you know, from a patient perspective or from a clinician perspective who's doing something, we're really single digit percentages.
I see. So there's still plenty of opportunity for growth.
It's mostly opportunity,
right?
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, let's come on to what I think is really the core question, and that is, what, in your view, are the key principles that can be defined to help AI adoption?
Yeah. So, one is to really make sure that the users, whoever is using the system, you know, sometimes it's a clinician, sometimes it's a technologist, sometimes it's a, you know, someone working in admissions. And I think it's important for them to understand what's underlying their device or application, as it were, so they understand exactly how this is going to help them in their workflow. It also depends on specifically on the use case. I think that's actually important to keep in mind. You know, some of the things, like I said, adoption goes really well because they're just running behind the scenes, and then there are other things where, yeah, they're kind of front and center in front of a clinician. You know, we'll talk about a few of those as we move, where they really have to know how the model's working and what the applications trying to do for them. Make sure there's good peer-to-peer mentoring. I think that's always important for anything. Another thing that's come up with AI in particular is this concept of they call it model drift, but the models are not really drifting. It's actually you take a model and you apply it to different data sets. Sometimes you get what's called drift. So they don't actually perform as well in the real world as they did it on your validation set. And so you have to monitor that. And then, as I said earlier, you know, this whole idea of seamless integration into the use case, right? So the easier it is for people to do, the quicker it's going to get picked up. You know, I have an iPhone that's got tons of AI applications built into it. I don't even think about where, you know, it's been using AI and where it's not, except for when it messes up when I try to talk to it and gets it wrong, that I know that the AI got it wrong. But otherwise, it's just invisible to me. I just use it. And the more we can embed AI into what we're doing end to end, the faster the adoption is going to go.
Okay, so you've talked about four principles there, I think. First, proper training for staff. Second, peer-to-peer monitoring, which is kind of similar to training in a way, I suppose. Third, you've talked about drift. And lastly, you talked about integration into workflows, right? Now, those all seem very sensible. Let's drill down into this idea of a drift, though, a little bit more. I mean, can you give an example of, I think what you mean is, you know, an AI tool can be developed and shown to work under some kind of clinical testing, ideal conditions in a way. And then when you actually implement it into the real world, then maybe it doesn't perform as well. And maybe the performance gets worse over time. Is that, can you explain a little bit about?
Yeah, no, I think you summarize it well, and it's you know we think about it a lot with AI because we're training these models and then we validate these models. So one of the challenges that you know we can come back to is this whole concept of where does the data come from, right? So one of the challenges for getting AI, more AI models built and deployed, is this access to data. This is healthcare data. You need real clinical data, and then you need really representative data sets to train models. And then separately, you need to validate those models. So you have to then test these models, you know, using other data in order to really prove that they're doing what they're supposed to do. But even with all of that, when you put them into real world settings and you're now working with a maybe more varied population or maybe a more narrow population, you may get different performance out of the model than you had initially anticipated. So you have to be able to monitor that and measure that. Let me give you an example from the genetics world, and I'm trying to think if this is exactly AI related or not, but I think it's a nice example. There have been lots of studies in breast cancer in women, and looking at genetics and progression, and there's all sorts of statistics that you can find. Now, it turns out that African American women tend to get more aggressive forms of breast cancer than non-African American women, at least in the United States, right? So it's an example of they've done these studies, and there's also a push, you know, to make sure the clinical studies and the clinical trials are more representative of populations. You have the same challenge with AI, and it's really hard to get that right.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because people who develop AI systems put so much time and energy and effort into training and gathering the data for those systems. The idea of starting completely from scratch because maybe your data is a bit out of date, that must seem pretty depressing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and look, one of the things that I'm heartened by is the regulatory agencies, you know, are coming out with guidelines and guidance on how to do this. And the FDA in the United States has recently, come out with some guidance on this, on the ability to say, well, okay, how do you update a model, right? How, you know, a model that's being, you know, already FDA approved and is already in clinical practice. There are mechanisms that you can use now to say, well, let's document. It's all, you have to document everything, right? So, but without having to go through an entire resubmission, there are ways to, I would say, contiguously update these models now. But you need the infrastructure in place to do this. You have to be getting the data. You have to be getting the telemetry from the model performance in order to be able to then update the model and then push that back out. But that continuous improvement of the model, I think, is also really essential. Everyone wins if you do that right.
All right. So why don't we drill down into a particular area of medical AI, namely imaging, which you touched on very, very briefly before. Could you just expand a bit on how, and feel free to take an example from Philips Healthcare. First of all, what do you think are the most exciting areas in machine learning for imaging? And also, could you maybe talk about the kind of challenges and resistance that maybe you face in getting these kind of systems deployed?
Yeah, good question. So as far as some of the more exciting areas and ones at least I, you know, find exciting is the more impact that we can have, the better. So I'll give another clinical example that we've come across, and this is stuff that's been published by academic sites, and I think it's just some pretty cool science. So at the moment, hopefully we can take it a step further. But one of the challenges for, say, detecting lung cancer early, well, just back up, and lung cancer is a leading cause of cancer death globally. The best thing you can do for a lung cancer patient is to find the cancer early. That's harder to do than you would think, because lung cancer doesn't tend to present symptomatically until fairly late stage disease. So there's a lot of activity to say, can we get patients who are at risk, largely these are smokers, into screening studies, and can we potentially have other ways to kind of figure out if they're at risk for disease? And there are groups now that are working on what are called incidental findings. So you just have a CT exam for some other means or an X-ray, and looking at those images, can you detect what might be a lung nodule? And that work's been going on for years. But then maybe can you overlay that with the smoking status for the patient? Not the smoking status that they report or might be in their EMR system, because one day might not be in the EMR system that you're using, depending on where they're getting their exam. And two, it's unreliably reported from most of the doctors I talk to. But the picture of the lungs, for a lot of radiologists, they can tell you, hey, I can look at it and I can tell. Well, if you can look at it and tell, potentially the machine can look at it and tell and say, mm-hmm. hey, this patient is actually at higher risk. So this little thing that you found that may not be a nodule that you are worried about, given the conditions of the lung cavity, of the pleura, I actually think you should be worried about it. And so maybe you want to follow this patient up. So things like this to me are super exciting. I mean, they're very clinical. We're not yet there yet. But to me, these are very high impact applications.
So let's just imagine that you broke your toe. I broke my toe last year, actually. Or at least I thought I did.
Yeah.
And you're having an X-ray in your foot.
Yeah.
And then
you're not going to find a lung nodule.
No. Well, you might if your anatomy is a little bit unusual. But let's say the radiographer said, "Oh, look, could we just scan your lungs just to check that as well while you happen to be here?" I mean, would you, Louis Coulot, want to get a lung X-ray as well?
No. Why is that? I wouldn't. Right now, there may be other factors. Right, so now if I'm coming in for an exam, I'm at high risk because I'm a heavy smoker and I'm of a certain age, and the doctor might say, "Hey, I'd recommend you get into a screening program." I think that's important. A lot of these incidental findings, though, wouldn't be necessarily a broken toe, but it could be a broken rib or someone who's in a car accident where you're doing an exam of that part of the anatomy anyway, right? And that's what we mean by, these sort of incidental findings. And there's actually quite a lot of them. It's a really rich source of early detection. So spending some time and focusing in that space is I think pretty important.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point that hadn't really fully occurred to me before. It's very, very interesting. Look, why don't we talk about another kind of imaging, like ultrasound? Now, you mentioned that an ultrasound, a cardiac ultrasound at least, can measure things like ejection fraction, which I think roughly is the amount of blood that your ventricle can eject on one particular beat of the heart, right? So could you talk about those, maybe that and some other cardiac measurements and how systems have been developed for that?
Yeah, so in the ultrasound space, again, I think a lot of our work at Philips has really been to think about, can we semi-automate these measurements? Can we make it easier for the technician to actually do their work? You can use it for quality control. So you mentioned ejection fraction. There's also things like right ventricle volume. There's a dozen plus of these measurements that you can we say semi-automate, because ultimately it's going to be up to the healthcare professional to do the job and do a quality job there. And this also has to do with the intended use of the AI in the application. But if we can help to make it either more accurate or quality control it, or make it faster and easier, then we've made a actually fairly large impact in that space.
Okay. Now, let me ask you about one final area, and that's precision medicine or personalized medicine. Is Philips involved in developing systems for this?
Yes.
Before you might want to say what personalized medicine is.
So let me just give a definition, or at least the way I think about it. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example of something that we're doing, and I'll give you another example that I think is a really interesting application that we're not currently doing, but I think it's an interesting application. So when we think about precision medicine, or even before you get to precision medicine, you have the precision diagnosis. In my view, it's a way to take a step back from the patient and look at all of the signals. So when a patient presents, or sometimes even in a healthy population, you have these clinical signals. They're externally visible, right? Could be, skin color, or the way a patient is walking in their gait. Could be something the patient says or reports, right? So these are all things that are sort of external signals that the patient is presenting with. And then layered on top of this, we have kind of a first level of diagnosis. So, standard stuff like blood pressure and heart rate and body temperature and things like that. You take another step in this in terms of looking at some of the diagnostic modalities that we discussed, right? So each of these provides a lens into the biology. So for example, to detect aortic stenosis, so a narrowing of the aorta, mm-hmm. You really use an ultrasound or a CT exam to detect that. So it's, again, another way to kind of get at some biology. For a cancer patient, you might have the image of a tumor tissue that can contain additional information. Anyone who's connected to a patient monitor is generating a lot of data, this waveform data. So not just their pulse and respirations, but also their blood pressure, their body temperature, mm-hmm. even their oxygen saturation, right? So that their blood's carrying to their organs. This is all coming through. And then you can't really talk about precision medicine without talking about genetics and genomics. And thanks to companies like 23andMe, everyone, and Ancestry.com, I think everyone's exposed at some level to this world of genetics and genomics. But that provides an additional context to whatever we're seeing. And the way I look at it is really the integration of all this information, right? So you think about now the pattern that patient presents, and how we can help docs take, or not just docs, but anyone in healthcare, take the right next step with those patients. And that's how I think about anything in this space is, how do we help them with the right, whatever the right next step is, whether that right next step is, do we discharge this patient or not, or whether the right next step is, do we do a biopsy or not, right? It's always the next step in the patient's journey. So
sure.
Mm-hmm. Let me then give an example, right? So I talked earlier, we talked about the challenge around detecting lung cancer earlier and finding lung nodules. So now let's say you had the broken rib and you had your chest exam, and there's a suspicious lung nodule. What's next, right? So the next question for that patient is do we biopsy it or not? And the biopsy for a lung nodule is fairly invasive. It carries risk of pneumothorax, pneumonitis. You have to go through the chest wall to get at the inlet. Well, you can do it robotically, but it's a pretty invasive, procedure compared to like biopsying a skin lesion or something like that, which I have every few years. So it's not a simple question of, hey, do we just biopsy every lung nodule we see, right? Because it's not just the cost of the diagnosis and the pathology, but it's actually pretty invasive, for the patient as well. Now, for a large fraction of lung nodules, there's actually good guidance. It says if the nodule's growing at this this speed and the doubling time looks like this, and the patient is a smoker, which means they're more likely to have the disease, and there's a bunch of other factors that go into it, then we say, okay, these patients, we want to biopsy. And then likewise, on the other side, there's good guidance on patients that they can just watch. But there's still a big, large number of patients in the middle some estimates have it at 40% plus, where they call these indeterminate lung nodules. There's no really good guidance on whether or not you should biopsy these or not. And so it's really up to the clinician in terms of what they want to do. So one of the things we're looking at is, hey, can we incorporate data? Can we bring in, so there's actually, this is not stuff we developed at Philips, but we actually incorporate, we're part of a big ecosystem in healthcare. So we incorporate radiomics, risk classifier from a third party that has an FDA approved AI device to predict whether or not a lung nodule is malignant. But we add on to that a gene expression test, we add a proteomics test, and this is really pulls together precision medicine. Each of these is trying to predict with some degree of accuracy whether that nodule is progressing toward malignancy. We don't yet know what docs are going to do with the information, but that's the next step. That's the real world evidence step. So are they going to then biopsy these patients that they otherwise wouldn't have? And then if they do, are they going to find more cancer and be able to treat it earlier?
Okay, great. Now, you sound like somebody, I'm sure you are, you're an AI enthusiast, as most people in the field are.
Yeah.
And however, it seems to me that, especially since Elon Musk wrote his open letter, which scared the pants off an awful lot of people, there's an awful lot of concern amongst the public, and not just public, the government as well, about a runaway AI getting out of control and destroying humanity and that kind of thing. It seems to me that the forces of resistance against AI are kind of is building a bit. Now, what kind of pushing back do you think there is in the field of medical AI? Do you encounter this kind of resistance?
We do, but not because people think that, you know, ultrasound machines are going to destroy the world, right? So I think they're coming at it from a bit of a different perspective.
Yeah.
There's always been this resistance where the notion that, well, AIs are going to replace doctors, and that's not the case, right? It's just, and I think the medical community is now, the more they understand just, well, how much AI is already in the tools that they have, how much they use it in their personal life, right? How they sort of interact with it, they understand that's not the role of AI in medicine. So there's resistance there still, but I think there's also a lot of understanding now and acceptance that these are going to be, you know, even though the applications can be pretty powerful, they're all going to be fairly narrow in scope in terms of what they're trying to do. There's another aspect as well, which is, as mentioned earlier, the operational aspect, which is, you know, easier, lower barrier to entry. There's really not much in terms of, you know, regulatory, because you're not really affecting patients directly. You're really working on the operational side of healthcare, where it's a lot easier. But to your question, yeah, no, there is some resistance. Some of it, I think, has sparked some healthy conversation. We talked earlier about, you know, what can we do to deal with things like model drift? How can we make sure models are trained with the appropriate data sets? How can we make sure they're validated with appropriate data sets? You know, I think that's all good stuff. And I think things that the industry needs to pay attention to.
And I'm sure that you have conversations with the US government as well. I mean, what's the kind of emotional content of those kind of discussions? Are they really receptive to the benefits? At the same time, there are concerns. I mean, what's the kind of flavor of those concerns?
No, I think you answered it in the question. Yeah, they're very receptive to the benefits. You know, everyone understands, you know, the challenges that we have in healthcare, and if this is another tool in the toolbox to help accelerate that and address those challenges, then I think that's great. The concerns are, as they would with anything, especially when you get into something that is, you know, either a medical device or part of a medical device, you have the same regulatory concerns, you know, that you would always have. And I think that's actually good. I mean, I wouldn't want anything. I wouldn't want to be diagnosed by someone who's not trained in medicine. I wouldn't want to have a diagnostic run by a computer that didn't have the same rigor, you know, that any medical device, you know, ought to have.
Right. Good. But Lewis, you've given incredibly clear answers to my questions, so I'm really grateful to you. Now, there's one question which I ask everybody at the end, and that is, what is your favorite current example of medical AI that's got nothing to do with your own?
Ah, that's, you know, I like that question. So my favorite my favorite example of medical MI, medical AI that we didn't develop at Philips. I mean,
that's cheating. You're not.
No. It's good. You know. I'd have to go back and I don't know if this is the earliest, but I think it is. There was a expert system developed, I think at Stanford, called Meissen. I think in like 1970. And like today we would, you know, this is like the Model T, right? For compared to Elon Musk's Tesla, right? But I like it because it is AI. I mean, it's an expert system, so we would consider it pretty crude by today's standard. It's not machine learning. It's not generative AI, right? But it is technically AI. It was used. And it also shows you, you know, maybe just how long we've been doing this, maybe without realizing it, and also just how long, as you said, I think in the introduction, just how long the innovation actually takes, because, you know, we still have such a long way to go.
Mentioned by one of my previous guests, Mark Bornstein, in fact. So could you, say a little bit about what Meissen does?
Yeah, so it helps docs figure out what bacteria might be causing your infection. It's got around, I think, something close to 1,000 rules in it. And the whole idea is helping people get to a more precise diagnosis to lead, you know, to a better antibiotic treatment for the patients.
And in what sense is it AI, and how does it differ from what we, you know, what might be equivalent systems now?
Yeah, so you know, expert systems are basically rules engines. So you can expose it and very easily predict how it works. You know, you can, even though it's got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of rules in it, you know, it's going to appear extremely deterministic. You feed it the same inputs, you always get the same outputs. Now that's true of machine learning as well, but machine learning can sometimes appear to be non-deterministic because of the complexity of the input, and it's just a much simpler. It's a much simpler system. I mean, the analogy I gave was the Model T compared to a Tesla. It might be more like the brain of a jellyfish compared to the brain of a human. Like, technically, they're neurons and they're working together. But they're, you know, that's probably unfair to Meissen. It's probably smarter than a jellyfish. Maybe it's I don't know, something that's got at least a modicum of a neural network, an insect, you know, something like this. So yeah.
Yeah, these historical examples are really interesting. Oh, yeah. Well, look, Lewis, I'm very, very grateful to you for your time. It's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you very much indeed.
No, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. I'm Felix Beecher. Ping me on LinkedIn for more information on Omdia's services in healthcare technology. See you next time.